Hello and welcome to Chats, a television podcast, season 12, Peaks Chats. My name is Magellan, and I'm joined by a co-host in a dress with a slit cut halfway up to Seattle. It's Alan.
What if he's like older IRL Goofy, and this is just what happens when Goofy gets old? His laugh kind of
works. Wow, that has to be what it is.
Yeah, I think that makes sense, and I think that Chats, a television podcast, makes sense as the number one television podcast that you're listening to right now.
Welcome to it. We watch Twin Peaks currently, two episodes a week currently, and this week we watched season 2 episode 20, The Path to the Black Lodge, and season 2 episode 21, Miss Twin Peaks. The Path to the Black Lodge was directed by Stephen Gyllenhaal. No relation?
Unless?
We'll find out. It was written by Harley Payton and Robert Engels, and it aired April 18th, 1991. Now, Alan.
Yes?
We're curious about three things. We're curious about how you're doing.
Oh.
I feel like I went straight past that without even asking. We're curious about if Stephen Gyllenhaal is related to the Gyllenhaals that we are familiar with, and we're curious about what happened in the Path to the Black Lodge.
I'm doing very well. I'm excited to be on the long weekend. Stephen Gyllenhaal is in fact the father of Jake and Maggie Gyllenhaal.
Shut up. Stop it.
I will not. He also directed several episodes of Numbers.
Okay. I think we haven't mentioned, by the way, we have mentioned that Norma Jennings is played by mother of Rashida Jones. Mm-hmm. We have said that.
Peggy Lipton.
We haven't mentioned on pod that Eileen Hayward. Wow, it took me so long to summon both of those
good
names.
Good work, though.
Eileen Hayward is played by the mother of Zoe and Emily Deschanel.
I keep forgetting. Oh my gosh, that's very fun.
A lot of like Hollywood dynasty parents involved in Twin Peaks, oddly enough.
And Scott Frost, who plays Doc Hayward, is Mark Frost's. I keep forgetting if it's brother or dad. I think it's brother. Don't yell at me, whoever's in the chat, please. There's no chat, Alan. It's a podcast. Okay, so The Path to the Black Lodge, right? In this episode,
yeah.
Bobby and Shelley reaffirm their love. Boo. Cooper calls Shelley. Ooh, Donna and Audrey look together. Oh, I forgot how comments work. I'm keeping that. Cooper calls Shelley, Donna, and Audrey together to warn them about Earl. Briggs shows Cooper a tape of Wyndham Earl making a report on his quest for the Black Lodge. Yeah, so, you know how I said that the back end of season 2 suddenly gets good again? Uh-huh. There's like literally individual shots where it's good. But we're so far past that like the reintroduction of spooky Twin Peaks is so far very awkward.
Yes.
I think literally the last shot of this episode is good. I was like, okay, this is good. But other than that, I was like, this show's really stupid and bad.
Yeah, the bit at the end where we're going through all these like hallways that we recognize, but they're empty and scary. And then we see Bob reemerging from thin air. That was pretty good. I agree. And I also really liked we can talk about Cooper and Annie's romance, the scene where they're, you know, romancing each other in the double R and the camera's pulling away and the music is getting louder and louder and more scary. And then Cooper is so eager for the smooch that he knocks over a bunch of plates and breaks them. And then you get that shot of the close up of the maple syrup, like dripping like blood over the cracked plates and stuff. I thought that was pretty good.
Think about how evocative that is, right? Like America, icons of America, Americana, like diner food and pancakes and syrup, but dripping in slow motion like blood, like the unsettling nature of that. Mm-hmm. I know this otherwise, besides the fun little touches here and there of something creepy sneaking into the show, this episode is very bog standard, but
yeah,
that
visual before we don't talk about it anymore, but that visual of Bob emerging at the end,
we'll loop
also,
back to that. Yeah,
okay. It's also kind of undercut by the fact that we just saw Bob a couple episodes ago being like, what happened to Josie, Cooper? Yeah. I'm here.
Put it down.
So it's not like we haven't seen him in forever. I don't know. Mm-hmm. So that was a little strange. But anyway, go ahead. Sorry.
God, the problem with drinking coconut water with particulates in it is that I have to chew on the particulates between times when I'm going to talk.
Do you want me to keep talking?
No, I'm all set. Thank you.
Okay.
Margaret Lanterman opens the episode. Oh, the other thing I was just going to say about those touches is I genuinely forgot what they were building up to. I knew that, like, a Bob thing was going to happen in this episode. I just remember, like, the Path to the Black Lodge has a Bob scene. But I forgot about the hand jittering thing.
Yeah, everybody's hands shaking.
Yeah, I thought that was really well done, especially because it's never really delved into. I think, to theorize, obviously, it's just a heads up that something bad is coming back. Because mm-hmm. the very first time it happens, it's like, it's in a scene that's so benign. I mean, it's like a, I think it's a Shelley Bobby scene or something where he says, like, I love you. But it starts on, like, an older woman who's in front of them in frame. And she's just, like, eating pie and being like, yum, 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 pie. And then she drops the fork and, like, her hand is just shaking so much. And, you know, we've zoomed past people in the double R before in funny ways. Like, the hot damn, that pie is good. That guy.
Yeah.
But now it's like, now it's suddenly very creepy that there's just a woman. And it's like, why was that woman there? And then why is Pete's hand shaking? And why is Cooper's hand shaking? Well, it's because evil is back, y'all. I thought that was really well done.
Yeah.
But we are also dealing with the aftermath of our boy Rusty Tomosky dying tragically inside of a chess piece, and his friend who recently topped the Twin Peaks Wiki's list of most popular pages laments his death and gets very sad that his friend is dead. The reason that guy was topping it was because he's played by the guy who played Stanford Blatch on Sex and the City. Willie Garson is the actor's name. Tragically,
and that guy passed away recently, right?
Yeah, like very, very recently. September of 2021. You know, iconic gay actor, gay character, great. I actually like him on the one episode of Sex and the City I watched. But like, he's in this and he's just like, I my friend, we were gonna get beers and we were gonna go get party, and then and it's so funny that imagine like the circumstances that one of them, they're like, we saw an old guy and he said that they had beers and he went and I didn't. It's like good friend, dude. You just like left your friend to go get beers with a stranger in the woods and you were like, oh wow, he died. That's so weird. Like,
yeah.
Makes no sense really, but I do enjoy this scene just because Andy crying is always fun for me. It makes me feel good that men show their emotions. And so the Windham Earl stuff just kind of fades into the background for a while. We can touch on just a couple of brief plot lines that get fleshed out here. Does that sound like a fun sort of?
Yeah, well, do we want to just talk about the whole what happens with Windham Earl, just to talk about it?
Sure. Do you want to talk about the newly introduced most important character in all of Twin Peaks? Cappy?
Who?
You don't remember Cappy? Oh my God, I'm so glad that you don't remember Cappy. You watched the episode.
Wait, who's Cappy?
So Windham Earl at one point, not Windham Earl, what's the other guy's name? Briggs. Has a guy who's on assignment with him. He's like, I need you to research the Dugpuzz. When they're talking about the fucking Dugpuzz, which Windham Earl describes as like the evil magical people that are controlling everything. And he just like shoos a guy away. He's like, Cappy, go do this. And then later, I think in that scene, Cooper's like, go, good luck researching the Dugpuzz, Cappy. And those two lines are the only time apparently, according to the wiki, Cappy was also seen in episode 13. I don't remember. Maybe he's one of the other book, he's a bookhouse boy.
Oh, okay. He's
yeah.
Got it. Yeah, do not remember Cappy at all. Couldn't tell you what he looks like.
He's
in
the
any
most.
Way.
He looks like Dave. Okay, who's the Dave that you like?
I don't know.
Dave, famous actor. He plays a lot of side characters. I can see his face so clear. He's got big eyebrows.
David Hyde Pierce.
No, younger.
Dave. Oh, Franco?
God, I need this. I really need this, dude.
What has he been in? Give me some Dave. What's Dave been in?
He was in that Robin Williams, Sarah Michelle Gellar show, I think. Maybe he wasn't.
Oh.
No, not that guy. David Krumholtz! David Krumholtz is who I was thinking of.
Oh, wait, now I need to look at David Krumholtz real quick.
Oh,
is he
my
the
God.
Guy with the face?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Look up David. I'm dying.
Oh, he's in Numbers.
There, it all comes back to Numbers, baby. Follow
talk about Numbers.
I can't breathe. I'm dead, fam.
And in the Santa Claus, of course.
Of course, iconic role, an iconic film.
Iconic role in the Santa Claus.
So Cappy, it looks like David Krumholtz with an afro. He's not important. There's archival footage of Winnie Earle describing these Doug Puzz for as part of Project Blue Book.
Yeah, basically the whole Winnie Earle plot. Everything we learn about Winnie Earle in this episode serves to explain that something that I like to a certain extent, which is that Winnie Earle is not really here to do this like serial killer murder thing.
Right.
That's actually a bit of theater to disguise the fact that he's here to find the Black Lodge and get into it and channel the powers of the Black Lodge to have the powers. And he learned about it through Project Blue Book. Cooper makes a bunch of leaps of logic and is like, oh, maybe that's connect. Maybe that says in the next episode. I don't remember. But, oh, it's connected to Bob. Oh, that's all the evil is linked together. And it more directly ties Wyndham Earle into like the lore in a way that I think, I don't know. I think that makes him a little more interesting. It also makes all of this a little more coincidental. It just so happens that the guy that he hates the most in the world is in the place where he needs to go find the superpowered thing.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It starts to, the logic of it all starts to, it definitely feels like a retcon kind mm-hmm. of, but I think it's a useful one because it moves us back towards Bob adjacent stuff, which is where the most successful, you know, antagonistic forces in the show reside.
Exactly. Yeah, and it also feels like a retcon in the sense of like, okay, what are all the different like contingent parts of his plan and what do they mean? For example, why does he actually have Leo in here? And as we see in the second episode, he's planning to put a cage full of spiders on Leo, or if he doesn't do everything he says. And I guess it's so his handwriting can be used to write the letters, but like they already know who you are, dude.
Yeah. It doesn't really make sense. there's not really any sort of reason to it. He just wanted to have a guy around, I guess. I mean, Leo also just kind of like stumbled into his zone and he made the most of it. Like it wasn't even really part of Wyndham Earle's plan.
Yeah.
Per se. The other thing, not to turn this into the show where we poke holes in Wyndham Earle's plans because they just don't really make sense. But I don't know if I've said this before on an episode, but what is the logical in-world connection between Shelley, Donna, and Audrey?
Beautiful women?
Right. Is that it? Like,
and Annie.
Is that the... Well, what do you mean?
Annie's also included in that.
I know, but Wyndham Earle, when he rolls into town and he's like, I got to find a candidate for my queen, I've narrowed it down to these three women. They don't even all have like a connection to Cooper, which could have been an organizing concept for Wyndham Earle. And that's why he ends up choosing Annie, is because of Cooper's connection to her. But like, what's the logic of that other than like you're saying they just happen to be the three young pretty ladies who are like main cast members on the TV show?
Well, I thought sorry to interrupt you, but when he first captured Leo, he was like, okay, who are like the princesses? And then he showed him photos of Donna, Shelley, and Audrey and was like, which one of these is our queen? Which never really paid off, actually. And also, he had those photos before asking Leo, so it's not implied that Leo like picked them for him. I think it is just like, you know, young women, capturing young women sort of thing.
And it's just like, these are the characters that the audience knows already.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it just, I mean, when Cooper brought them all together, it just made it even more apparent that like, that was a plot thread that like you're saying did never go anywhere. Like putting the three of them in danger didn't do anything because none of them felt like they were in danger. And
yeah.
I don't know, the casualness where they were all like, huh, did anything else happen on that day? Well, I met a really strange guy. I also met a strange guy. Yeah, me too. I met a really strange guy. And Cooper's like, yeah, that strange guy was Wyndham Earl.
Well, Magellan, you're at the, maybe, and I'm just spitballing here.
Uh-huh. Okay, okay.
They're all related somehow to Cappy?
Shut up.
My grin grew like a Cheshire Cat or like the Grinch when I heard you giggling.
Cappy's the key to everything.
Cappy's the key to everything, guys. Okay. You know that.
All right.
It gives the episode some stakes, some juicy venison stakes to be like, all right, all the girls need to report their location and be extra, extra safe. If you drive, make sure you're with someone, like all that stuff. Don't go out at night, which, like, unfortunately, the world we live in, you shouldn't go out at night alone anyways, especially if you're a woman. Okay. Mm-hmm. Twin Peaks, almost saying something. Yeah, there was some other Wyndham Earl stuff that I remember enjoying, though. It was the second episode where we get all the first person shots from Leo's perspective.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I want to talk about those when we get there. And otherwise, I mean, he's just a kind of a creepy guy and he's making plans and his plot doesn't seem to be connected to the Bob stuff also. Like, he is trying to go to the Black Lodge, but like then Bob gets out of the Black Lodge. It just seems like they're on separate dimensions.
Yeah. And also, I don't know. Maybe this will become clearer when he comes across Bob, because it seems like that's where we're going. But Bob also, when he was in Leland's body talking to Cooper in that one episode, was like, oh, thing for knives, just like in What Happened to You in Pittsburgh, Cooper.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, Bob seems to have some connection to Wyndham Earl or to what happened to Caroline. And I don't know. I don't remember how explicitly or not they address that or make sense of that.
Well, so finale's next week, so this definitely won't justify a spoiler section, but do you remember the fate of Wyndham Earl?
Yes.
Okay. So some stuff is going on with the Black Lodge and Wyndham Earl, and he's trying to get there and he's a sneaky part. My biggest laugh of the episode came from Wyndham Earl, actually. And it is when he captures Major Briggs in the woods by walking up to him dressed like a horse.
A cow, I think.
Oh, is there any significance to that at all?
No. No.
Just a dude walks up to you in a cow costume and goes, hey, what's up? And you go, huh? And he pulls out a fucking gun and shoots you with a trank dart. And you're like, and then it's kind of sad, but Major Briggs, in one of his like last scenes of the show, I think, I don't know, they always have to rescue him. Or they do rescue him. But, like, we're winding down, and one of our last Major Briggs scenes is him just being filled with haloperidol and being loopy. Mm-hmm. And it bums me out, because it's like, this is how we're going to do Major Briggs now? Okay. Mm-hmm. I also just laugh at, like, how do you conceive of a scene like, and then Wyndham Earl goes in a cow costume and shoots Briggs in the leg or whatever. Like, what? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Deeply strange. Deeply strange. Yeah. He has like some back and forth with Briggs when they're in the cabin. He asks him, what do you fear most in the world? And Briggs says, the possibility that love is not enough. And it's like, is Twin Peaks a good show again? But this is like the season one good show stuff where it's like mood for the sake of mood. Like, when has that idea been seeded in Twin Peaks? The possibility that love is not enough. I guess like you can really dig and be like, people loved Laura, but love was not enough to save her.
Sure.
I don't know. You have to dig, though. The show doesn't really give you anything there.
Yeah, I mean, I think something that we sort of gain a consciousness of in these two episodes is, is it in the second episode that Cooper tells Truman about how he saw Bob when Josie died?
Believe so, yes.
Can I just talk about that now
real
quick?
Yeah.
So Cooper's like, oh, Truman, you know, I saw Bob. I think that Bob is attracted to fear, basically. And it seems like what we're saying is that fear opens the Black Lodge, love opens the White Lodge. And so maybe what Briggs is saying has just sort of like a normal philosophical meaning of like, what if love is not enough to make life good or to save us from sorrow or whatever? or to help people. But it also could be this more cosmic question of like, what if we just can't love hard enough to like open the White Lodge or to like fight back the evils or something. Mm-hmm. So there's something there, but it ultimately is collapsing the moral universe of Twin Peaks into something as complex as like the Jedi and the Sith, you know, which I'm not a huge fan of.
Only a Black Lodge resident thinks in absolutes. To me, the Dugpuzz are evil. come on, I can think of one more. I can think of one more. I hate trees. They're coarse and also, doesn't Andy say I hate trees?
No, Cooper says this.
I don't want to talk about trees anymore.
But there it is.
That's the next episode. That's the only clip I have from the next episode.
It's from the grossest scene ever. Yucko.
We'll talk about it later.
So the episode ends. We're not done talking about this episode, but the episode does end with Bob stepping out of a circle in the middle of the woods, and there's red drapes and imagery, and he's like, I'm back! Mm-hmm. And that's it. Bob's back. He's alive, and I'm alive! Oh my god, if Bob said that when he came back, the show would be better. For sure.
And we sort of canonically confirm. I think one thing that's kind of interesting about the cosmology here is this idea that the Black Lodge and the White Lodge are not just they're not just like metaphysical constructs or like other dimensions or something. They're like physical spaces that you can go to. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of half-baked in this episode, but Cooper is sort of speaking to, and Wyndham Earle says this in the tape that they find about him, that the Black Lodge is a place that exists somewhere at some time.
Yeah,
time that we can get to. And so this episode at the end says like, and look, it's down there. It's in the puddle. just go in that puddle. You'll find it.
Mm-hmm. Take a dip. I don't think it's water. Well, they'll describe it in the finale, I think. Whatever that weird thing in the woods is.
I think it's syrup, maple syrup.
Oh. Yeah. Lucy announces that she's going to announce D-Day. Not the day that a K-pop song comes out, not the day that we invaded Normandy, but Dad Day. Which means that she's going to pick the father of her child on the day of the Miss Twin Peaks pageant. That's all we get in this episode. The answer is revealed next time on Twin Peaks. Yeah.
I did enjoy Lucy trying to sort of make her own life into a reality show.
Yes. And
basically give the commercial pitch. Tomorrow, you'll find out who the dad is. And Andy's like, okay. Anyway, I can help you with your speech, I guess.
You want to talk about the woods? Okay, I can write about the woods.
Oh, yeah.
Donna investigates her attic looking for information about who her real dad is.
Can I ask you something?
Yeah.
What's your least favorite Twin Peaks season 2 plot right now? Is it
right now?
Option A, Donna is trying to figure out if Ben Horn is her dad. Option B, Audrey Horn telling John Justice Wheeler that she's a virgin and they have sex in his private jet. Option C, Cooper and Annie are making out everywhere that they can possibly make out. Option D, Catherine and Andrew trying to open increasingly smaller boxes.
Well, that one goes from my least favorite plot in season 1 to one of my favorite dumb plots in season 2 because of the absurdity of it. I thought you were going to say, like, wow, you mentioned all the bad ones without mentioning Catherine, but you did. No, the puzzle box one is hilarious. It's so stupid. The anyone just makes me feel like I'm on something because I don't fundamentally agree with this romance that's happening. I don't like seeing it. The Audrey one basically feels the same way. It feels undercooked and betrays the. I'm trying to think which one betrays the characters the most. And then honestly, Donna's like makes sense for her at the very least. It's not that interesting, and the answer is not that interesting. But like, it makes sense. And that scene when she's in the attic is really cool, where like the light is flickering or whatever, and there's like noise in that, the fan noise. I was like, this is well made.
Mm-hmm.
I can appreciate the craft of this scene. But yeah, so I think to actually answer your question, Audrey Wheeler is my least favorite.
Okay. Okay.
Visceral anger at the plane scene.
I think I hated the plane scene a lot. I think the Donna plot is, I think it's the one that's bothering me the most because it is just a twist for no reason, mm-hmm. right? It's just like,
she
what if
something to do?
Yeah, what if Donna was Ben Horn's daughter, maybe, huh? What do you think? And it's like, has Donna ever had any sort of interaction with Ben Horn prior to this point? Do we understand what she thinks of him? Like, is this meant to be? We just don't understand the extent to which this is like a horrific realization for her, or really
anything
like that. It just doesn't say or mean or do anything. I think something that's confusing to me about it also is it doesn't fully track with the other Ben Horn stuff that's going on, mm-hmm. because he's saying like, oh, I want to be a good guy. Right. And we can tell that when he's talking about the weasels and how he wants to be a good guy, that there's this ulterior motive of wanting to mess with Catherine Martell's development project. And so you can have a debate about like, okay, well, is he a genuine environmentalist or no, he just wants to mess with them. But with this, I don't, it adds a, it like muddles this whole, is Ben Horn really being a good guy thing, because he doesn't have an ulterior motive to tell Donna anything and to bust up the Hayward family. There's no like benefit that comes to him for doing that. It seems like it is a genuine misguided moral question of like, well, I'm supposed to tell the truth, right? And I just I don't know. I don't think that they're playing it in a way that's really all that interesting, considering that on the other side of his plot, he's doing something that's like a little more transparently
evil.
Yeah, just like Machiavellian in the way that Ben Horn is.
Right. Yeah, to try and have your cake and eat it too, where it's like, okay, is Ben Horn becoming a good person and like reconciling something he did in his past? And also, is he, you know, still trying to betray Catherine and like secure the Ghostwood estate? Mm-hmm. Those two things don't gel very much. There's a scene in the second episode that we'll talk about with the books where it's mm-hmm. like, you're trying to be a good dad now? What are you doing? Like, you can't do both of these things. It's not allowed.
And even that turns into like a clear manipulation of Audrey, where you can see how it fits into Ben Horn's scheme. Mm-hmm. Whereas this Donna stuff, I like, what's the scheme here? Yeah. And it's not to say that there has to be one, but you're just making that his character right now. And this doesn't really, like you're saying, gel with that.
Totally. But let's drill in on the rest of this episode before we get into, because all of these plots do resolve in the second one. But she's looking for photos. She's looking for, through records. No father is listed on her birth certificate. She sees pictures of Ben Horn with her mom, and he has a great mustache, which is really good.
So good.
Top tier mustache, literally unparalleled.
We also see him shirtless in this one, which is pretty fun.
Oh, yeah. I wrote that in my notes. I wrote shirtless Ben Horny. Which is something that I wrote. Bobby and Shelley, speaking of men who can't decide which character they want to be, Bobby is now like, no, but like Shelley, like doing all this stuff made me realize that I actually really love you and that we should like get married and I love you forever. Do you guys forget that Bobby like abandoned her? We don't care. Okay.
I mean, he does say all that, right? He does say, I've been really shitty. I've been wearing suits and thinking that I'm the man. And at least there's a reason why he's having this change of heart. I mean, yeah, it is kind of goofy town because this is all the reason that he gives.
I saw you kissing that guy. Something snapped. It was like my brain rolled over and I could see all of the stuff that was special to me.
Like, yeah, that's not really the most compelling reason, but I don't know. I just like seeing Bobby and Shelley together.
Ultimately, yeah, it's true. And he has not been like physically abusive with her the way so many men have in this show. And so I think in the grand scheme of like, you know, we've joked about doing a like Men of Twin Peaks tier list, Bobby doesn't like fail every account compared to people who are literally like, you know, wife beaters, to sorry to use the term, like, you know, Leo, for example. Bobby is just like a shitty teen who is a little bit unsure what he wants, but knows that he likes this girl a lot, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we don't have to get into the territory of like ranking.
No, I know.
Yeah, but I think what Bobby explains, like what he's done, he's been mm-hmm. neglectful and kind of a douchebag. And I think that's a repairable damage because he does genuinely love Shelley and like initiates this conversation himself of saying like, look, I've been acting this way. And Shelley clearly wants to mend fences. And she says, like, I miss you, Bobby. And I think it just makes the scene sweet in a way that I don't have a problem enjoying it.
Whereas you mentioned in a previous episode, the way that the show was like, is Leo okay? It's like, that doesn't work so much.
Goodbye, wife.
Yeah, goodbye, wife.
Goodbye, wife.
I mean, they're still doing it, right? Because he tries to break out of Windermere's thing to like to be with Shelley or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it's like, dude, you can't go away. get him out of the show. Briefly, Dwayne is talking to Lana and he says Dick Tremaine is going to be the judge and you should flirt with him and then you can win. She wants our man, Dwayne Milford, to rig the Miss Twin Peaks pageant. He says, I'll try, baby. But he gets very mad with her. He's like, why do you got to be such a tease? Why can't we get married?
You're so strict with me. I do have two clips of him from this scene. I took four total clips from both these episodes because I really was bored with them. And two of them were Dwayne Milford.
Good.
This guy is the MVP of this period of season two. Unquestionably. He also has that bit later where he's like trying to make the mic work and he's
turned into the giant scene was pretty sick. Like yeah, him we'll fumbling talk, with it. Yeah.
We'll talk about that. But these are the two lines from him talking to mm-hmm. Lana.
It's in the bag.
that's just good. It's in the bag. Bah. And then I really liked the way that he said this next line was like a little out of character. And sounded just like how the real actor talks, but I really liked it. He's talking about Dick Tremaine, and he says,
oh, my God, this guy is a British or Bahamian or something.
Bahamian.
The way he's like, oh, my God, this guy's, I don't know. He's
the
British,
oh, my God, could not have been in the script. The oh, my God really does sound like he put that in.
Yeah.
Can you play it again?
Oh, my God, this guy's a British or Bahamian. Or something.
It might be an awkward line read. It's very funny.
I love it so much.
Oh my god.
Oh my god.
That's so fucking funny to me. I don't know why.
He brings us joy. What can I say?
He's great. And then the way that he cries and it sounds like his laugh. Oh, top notch.
Truly amazing. Not so amazing. Cooper thinking about Annie, like he's a simp or something.
Oh my God. Let's talk about this whole Cooper. Yeah. He tells Truman in this one, right? Like, I'm thinking about Annie. Oh my gosh. Oh, Annie, I've been thinking about you. And then we continue this trend of Heather Graham being like, yeah, I am thinking about you too.
I've been seeing your face in fried eggs all this morning.
You are the man for me. You are such a handsome man and I love you. Like the lines that they're writing for her are it's
oh, I will man. Teach you how to dance. Just think of it as a walking embrace.
The part where they're at the dancing event, and she has that whole monologue about I don't even know what, about like it's okay for me to like you. It just feels like it's off like a you're in a gas station. And you're grabbing like a romance novel or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's just like stuff that you could get into and read in a book. I'm not trying to disparage gas station romance novels. Read your thing. Do what you want. But that kind of dialogue doesn't translate very well to television because she's just like, oh, Cooper, I have thought quite a bit about the love that we share in our hearts. And even though the world can be scary to me, you know, it's like overdone and wordy and weird.
It's very,
and then she's like, I want more than your kisses. Like, anyway.
Isn't that in this episode, the sex thing in this one or no?
Sex thing's in the next one. Okay, but great. But she says, I want more than your kisses. Mm-hmm. And then the mayor, you know, kind of busts up the mood a little bit.
Yeah, right.
But there's a lot of female characters in this one, which is fine and could have been done well, but was done poorly. But a lot of female characters in this one being like, I want to have sex with you. Like Shelley being like, I miss the things we used to do together. And this from Annie. And then, of course, the Audrey moment.
We got to hold it. Hold it.
We got to hold it.
Hold it. Before we get to it.
What was your reaction when Dwayne Milford turned into the giant? And he's fucking, going, no.
It's perfect. It's the funniest giant scene. The giant is not as cool as people remember him being. I mean, I love that actor. I think Carol Struycken is a cool guy. And like it's like the mood of it is cool. But he just comes in to be like, Cooper, shit, dude. It's not going good. Anyways, peace. I gotta go Cooper. To the White Lodge again.
Don't.
We just see him mouthing the word no over and over again. Like, don't go with Annie. Don't let this Annie thing take you over. Basically, is what he's implying. But he's literally just going, no, like mouthing it. That's it. The giant is, but yeah, Dwayne, like, it's because what's so funny about it is the microphone keeps fucking up. And, you know, Annie is like, ugh, I wish he would stop interrupting us, talking about how we want to have real sex. And then it like fucks up and falls and keeps falling and keeps falling until it goes through the floor. And then that's when the giant's like, what's good, Koopy?
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was cool. Because you get to watch Dwayne like crouch, like, it's falling. I'm talking, but it's falling. Yeah.
Yeah. I thought it was a pretty well timed insert of the giant. I thought it worked a lot better than in whatever the one was where Josie died and Bob and the man
the condemned woman
show up. The condemned woman, that's right.
Unforgettable. Actually very highly forgettable. He also and then cutting back to Dwayne and he goes, this isn't right. There's something wrong here. That's well done, guys. You did a good
Yeah, that was pretty good.
You really nailed that.
Yeah.
Speaking of Catherine Puzzle Box. Whatever. There's they fucking it's so funny. Before I make the embarrassing joke I was about to make.
Yeah. You really saved yourself from that segue.
Yep.
Me
at the mall dodging Paul Blart.
Okay, that's pretty funny. All of this puzzle box stuff is delightfully
so funny. They all found this puzzle box. It's Andrew, it's Pete, and it's Catherine. And she's like, what the fuck do we do? I misspoke last week and I said that Pete opened it. He opened the box containing the box.
Yes.
That part opens easily. Then the part inside of it opens with like a puzzle with like phases of the moon. Inside of that is a black box. And they're like, what could it possibly be? And it won't open. And then finally, Andrew, like a rich guy, is like, well, how do I fix things? And she pulls out a gun and shoots it like three times. Mm-hmm. Catherine freaks out. He's like, oh, my God. And then it actually opens. And it's a key.
Yeah.
To another box.
Right. Here's the thing about the box. I mean, it gets to the point where it feels like it is meta. Almost. Yeah. And if it was meant to be that way, it's great.
Mm-hmm.
But if it was genuinely meant to be this like mysterious thing, it's a little ridiculous because three out of the four box openings, they just brute force it.
Yeah, yeah.
They drop it, smash it, and shoot it with a gun. And then the other one, he's just like punching in dates, and the answer is the day that the box arrived.
It's like, not a puzzle.
Why? What kind of puzzle is this?
It's not. It's another rich man being like, fuck you guys. He's my last troll. We are talking a little bit more about the second episode. So the last thing I'll say in this one, for sure, before we move on, is my least favorite plot of season two.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. I don't disagree.
I didn't want it to be this. I wanted it to be so many other things. But just the specific way that this ruins Audrey, who was legitimately one of my favorite characters on this show, period, and just throws all of her character development in the trash to say, well, Wheeler's leaving. He checks out once and for all, finally, to go to Brazil to take over the business from his friend who tragically passed away, who we will never learn about, by the way. Doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. And Ben tells her, well, he's at the airport or something. And she goes, okay. And she goes to the local airport. And she sees Wheeler there in his stupid leather jacket that I bet you smells like ass. I just look at it and I'm like, this is a stare. As someone who has a somewhat stinky leather jacket, I can like vibe with it, but his is worse. You think everything's fine. She's going to say, oh my God, it's going to be Casablanca. She's going to say, I love you. And he's going to be like, don't love me. He really just says like, I'll be back. Don't worry about it. This doesn't have to be goodbye. It is. But one more line. We're not done yet. Hey, Wheeler, I'm a virgin. Oh, Do you want me to take you right now? Yes. Okay. And then they have sex in his plane.
Yeah, Pete, wait out here. I'll be right back.
Pete's outside! Pete is outside watching because I guess I figured it out because the police are telling them to watch the girls. But like Pete's...
Oh, sure.
Yeah, it's not just completely random that Pete happens to be there. He has instructions to watch Audrey. But I do like to think that, yeah, Pete's just like, oh, having sex. And he looks on and like smiles. He's like,
he's crying a little bit because of the beauty of their love.
Mm-hmm. It's so pure and real. And she's not, I don't know how old is Audrey supposed to be? Audrey.
18.
Okay, we confirmed this, right?
Yeah, yep, she 18, said it 18. A couple episodes ago.
Yeah, she did. Okay, so still terrible. This sucks.
Yeah. And it's, I don't know. I mean, I don't think it's like wildly out of bounds for Audrey to say or to want, it's like it makes sense for Audrey to want to have sex with him. She has a crush on him or she thinks she's in love with him or whatever.
They're consenting.
And maybe it even makes sense for her to be like, I'm a virgin, blurting it out. You know, I don't know how to approach this, but I want to like have this experience. Mm-hmm. But it's hard to get past the fact that it feels a little like, I don't know, what's the word? Voyeuristic to sort of write it in this way. Like someone wrote the script, you know, that's what I just can't quite get past is I can see the sense in Audrey wanting this and saying this. And I think there's a way to make this work. But that moment where it turns from her saying, I'm a virgin, to him being like, oh, well, if you want to just, we could just right here. That moment to me is kind of grimy in a way that I didn't enjoy.
I have often felt like no one said this to me, but I feel like I'm a little bit overly critical of like sex stuff on TV shows when we talk about them on the pod.
I think I am too.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. It's just the way we think about media. And I really don't think that television shows should not handle like sexual intercourse or discuss the desire for that, because it's a real thing that people think about. I just think a more interesting version of this exists, right? Audrey, you're so young. You have so much life and mad and incredible things ahead of you. You shouldn't be with me. I'm, you know, a traveler and I live a dangerous life. You can do better and have a more stable relationship with someone who cares about you. I so want to come back to talking about Audrey down the line because I have a lot of thoughts, but right now it's like, the thing to remember is after these two episodes that we're talking about tonight, there's a Twin Peaks left, you know, like, and we're not going to get like the mill plot continuation in Fire Walk With Me. And certainly not in The Return, which is doing its own thing. And so, like, we have to think, like, these are some of the last times we're seeing these characters. And if this is one of the last Audrey scenes, then that's a big bummer to me. Is her going, like, well, I got the thing that made me happy, which was to have sex. Okay, great. Good.
Yeah. And I think they're, what you're describing, like, the more interesting version is literally what happened with Cooper, right?
Yeah,
where he's like, you know, this doesn't make sense. It's not going to work. You should be with somebody else. And I think it was Charlie who made a good point when he was on that, like, we're just not really seeing that experience with Cooper shaping the way that Audrey approaches this experience with Wheeler. Mm-hmm. It like kind of feels completely disconnected. And maybe there even could have been a moment where she does go through with this, does have sex with him, and it seems like she kind of regrets it a little bit at the end, or at least maybe doesn't regret it, but it feels heartbroken, and she can sort of process for herself, like, oh, maybe that didn't make any sense for me to pursue that guy. But that moment doesn't really happen. We don't close the loop, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. So here, just I need to punt it for now, but the Audrey stuff is a bummer. And with little left, let's do you have any straight notes before we move right into Miss Twin Peaks?
Well, she does go fishing with Pete afterwards, which is
redemption, finally. Pete is like, what did you want from that? And she's like, well, you know, we were going to do all these things. We were going to go fishing. And he goes, well, that's something I can do. And he says, what's the line? There's nothing better. I have it written down.
No better cure for heartbreak.
There are many cures to a broken heart, but nothing is like a trout sleep in the moonlight. Pete, Jack Nance.
That's pretty nice.
That's so sweet. They go. I wish we saw that. I wish we had one more minute to just see them
really
fishing.
Just need that fishing scene.
Mm-hmm. Give me, desktop background. Pete Martell fishing. Hold on, googling. That'd be a really good desktop background, wouldn't it?
That would be really good. Just I hope you find it.
Pete overlooking like a beautiful. Like I want fan art of that. Yeah, I'm not finding it. I'm getting shots from the pilot where he's holding the thingy, but somebody make that. Damn, that sounds like a good idea. Or like an aesthetic, like. Lo-fi mix or something. Twin Peaks lo-fi, and it's just Pete fishing. I'm up to something, y'all. But if that's what you got, Meg, then I say we take it to a brief musical break, and I also say that we should come back after this to talk about Miss Twin Peaks. The second episode we watched this week was Season 2, Episode 21, Miss Twin Peaks. This episode was directed by Tim Hunter. It was written by Barry Pullman, and it was aired June 10, 1991. What happened in this episode, Magellan?
Windham Earl sets his sights on the Miss Twin Peaks contest. Ooh. I'm channeling my Lana Milford accent, which is southern on a couple words. And then that's it. Lucy chooses a father for her baby. Leo is punished when he frees Major Briggs. Cooper unlocks the key to entering the Black Lodge. Annie and Dale make a commitment.
No, to what have sex?
Yeah, wait, what commitment did they make?
To
They just had sex, yeah, I guess.
We talked about all the good stuff in this episode already. Now we had to talk about the boring. No, there's still good stuff. The Mr. Beast pageant happens.
Yeah, is Windham Earl all bobbed up now?
I don't know. Because now he's got like
black teeth and he's really pale.
They never explain it. I know for a fact that they never really explain it.
Okay.
I think he's bobbed up though.
Okay.
God, people need to watch Ted Lasso. There's a part where somebody gets bobbed up in the end of Ted Lasso season 2. That's all I'm going to say. And I'm not going to explain. I can explain it to you off mic because I know you don't want to watch that show. Yeah, the log lady intro, by the way, just her talking about a log. It's fun, though, because they pan over to her fireplace for once. And she's like, you know, my log has a spirit in it, and the spirit is my dead husband. Anyways, check out my fireplace. This is where people die and stuff. Not the fireplace, but, you know, whatever. If Jupiter and Saturn meet, it's time to go to the Black Lodge. Magellan, are you excited?
Sure.
Okay. Are you excited for...
Go ahead.
I'm gonna just jump around from plots. You gotta stop me when you want to say
both
something.
Both of these episodes ended with a character being like, "It's not just a puzzle; it's a map."
Wait, the first one did too.
Yeah, Windham Earle was like, "Leo, don't you see? It's a map."
and then the second one is Andy.
Like, he's like, "Cooper, it's not a puzzle; it's a map."
I don't know if you knew this, but it's a map. And wow, I didn't even realize that.
It's like, is that? Am I supposed to be like, what the fuck? Like,
it
what
looks
else
like
is it
a map.
Be? It looks like a map. Yeah, exactly. It looks like a map.
Why didn't we know it's a map, actually? True question. Very strange. I agree. Very, very strange. But it's a map, and if you draw a line through it, then you realize where the Black Lodge is in the woods. It's a secret. Secret map. The joke of Andy being the only one who knows where that is pretty dope.
Yeah, I like that he figures it out.
And everyone's like, no, shut up, Andy. He's like, but Agent Cooper. Like, this episode would have been solved in 5 seconds if people listened to Andrew. Andrew.
All right.
I said that because I was reading the word Audrey because I was going to talk about the Audrey foot shot, gratuitous foot content.
Yuck. It's just another one of those shots where whoever's behind the camera didn't have to make that choice.
Tim Hunter, fight me.
Tim,
the dude is a weird director. Hey, Tim.
Bud, you didn't have to make that choice, bud.
She's like talking to... Ben is manipulating his daughter into entering the pageant, which makes me sad, which is a bummer of a moment,
it's
right?
It's a real bummer, yeah.
It feels like... Because it's like accurate parental shittiness. I feel like he's done this before.
And I think it's a bummer in a way that works, right? Like, we're slowly peeling back the layers of Ben Horn's feigned goodness to see that he is just being bad in a different way. And I think that that actually makes a lot of sense for his character.
Mm-hmm.
But it is sad because Audrey just wants to have a genuine relationship with her dad. And he's like incapable of that.
You can psychoanalyze it too and say she's pursuing this relationship with Wheeler because she's not getting a like relationship with an adult man being her father.
Sure.
You know, like she doesn't have a father figure, but that's, you know, neither here nor there. He's saying like, you know, I read these religious texts like the Bible and the Quran and the Torah and all this stuff. And I know all about the philosophy of good now, which is bullshit. And he's like, you're my daughter. You sad about a boy?
Oh, you
or
seem
something?
Sad. Okay. Sure.
It's like when you want to talk about something with someone, but they have a completely different issue, and you have to remember to listen. You're like, wait.
Yeah.
Oh, What you got going on? You got a boy? Oh, Wheeler. Let's talk about the Winterall stuff briefly. He goes very Joker mode in this more than he already has. He literally says, "I haven't been this excited since I punctured Caroline's aorta."
Oof, that's a lot.
Transitioning hard from he's a wacky Scooby-Doo villain to like he's a murderous sociopath, is rough. And he says, "Leo, if you mess with me one more time, I'm gonna send you to that." And he points to a big head box full of spiders. Gross.
Yeah.
And the other directorial thing that Tim Hunter does is Earl always faces the camera when he yells at Leo in this episode, as if we're supposed to like be in Leo's like interiority. Strange choice.
Yeah, there's a lot of investment in, I think, this episode. He's like looking at Shelley's picture, or maybe that's the first one. But there's just a few moments where, by contrast, when Leo is in the room with Windham Earle, it's like, okay, I guess he's not as bad as this cartoon villain man. And as a result, yeah, it creates these moments where, like you're saying, the camera wants us to empathize with Leo Johnson. And I just would rather not. No, thank you.
I don't want to be in his head. I don't want to be anywhere near him. Honestly, you can excise that whole thing. Yeah. Could you just remove Leo from Windham Earle's whole storyline?
I think the benefit of having Leo... I think Leo is a particularly useful character because it allows us to have a direct point of view, like a firsthand point of view on what Windham Earle's doing without us really being too concerned about the character who's giving us that perspective. Like, we're not really worried about when is Leo going to get saved or something like that. But we know Leo, and so it makes sense for us to sort of, for him to be the audience surrogate in Windham Earl's hideaway. It just has the unfortunate side effect that just like cinema knows how to speak a certain language, and that language like puts Leo in the position of being the victim, which he is, of Windham Earl. But like, I don't know. I think that is serving to weirdly thematically redeem Leo Johnson. And I'm not here for that necessarily.
We don't stand, you're saying?
Yeah, I would say we don't stand. It's not the fresh drip that I'm looking for. Yeah.
Fresh drip.
Sheesh.
Yeah. Hello, fellow teens. I want to talk about everything else around before we get to the pageant, because then we can just talk about the pageant for like 30 straight minutes, probably.
If we could do 45 straight minutes on the pageant.
I type 45 on the pageant, yeah. Garland stumbles out of the woods. He's like, he forgets his own name. He's like, Garland? That's an odd name. Like, Judy Garland? That's weird.
Pretty funny.
Pretty funny. The puzzle box thing happens in this episode. Donna's mad. Okay. Yeah, the puzzle box getting shot. They question it in the first one, and then this one, they shoot it.
Yeah.
Donna's in the back of the pageant yelling at Ben, being like, are you my dad? And he goes, I'm. And she goes, oh, you're my dad. Okay. Mm-hmm. All right, great. Mm-hmm. Good. Now I know the answer. Andy solves the whole crime.
Yeah. It gets picked as the dad.
Yay! He's so happy. Look at Andy go, or what's his fucking, the actor's name? Harry Goaz is just like... Yay! He's like so joyful there. Mm-hmm.
It's pretty nice.
And also the fact that Dick Tremaine's like, oh, okay.
Cool. I just had sex with Lana Milford in the closet like an hour ago, so I'm good. I'm out of here.
I get to judge a bunch of like young people on how hot they are, and I just had sex with the most beautiful witch of all time. I'm groovy, guys. See ya. Bummer. Sorry, Dick. Not that much of a bummer. I'd rather get out of here. Shelly and Annie are cute with Norma. They reveal that Norma was the winner of the Miss Twin Peaks pageant 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. Again, love Machin Amick and Heather Graham like being funny and charming. And they're like, oh, mm-hmm. my God, like Norma used to be so good. Like, what, you know, now you're old and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, this is a nice team of three characters to see hang out with each other.
It passes the Bechdel test.
Except that they're talking about a beauty pageant.
Fuck!
Feels like it should be written into the Bechdel test. You can't have women talk about men or a beauty pageant.
Yeah, that they all want to win or one of them used previously won. It's bad. Yeah. Yes, that's definitely true.
So this is a very minor plot question.
Go ahead.
I was under the impression that the judges for the Twin Peaks pageant were Pete Martell, Doc Hayward, and the mayor mm-hmm. Milford. And then the judges in fact are Mayor Milford, Dick Tremaine, and Norma Jennings. Did that just get switched at some point?
When was it implied that Pete was one of the judges?
Well, when they were like screening the contestants, Pete Hayward and the mayor were the ones who were doing that.
That's interesting. I don't know why or how they picked them. I didn't actually think about that much.
Cause it doesn't makes Doc Hayward's like emceeing the event now,
yeah,
which feels more like what Dick Tremaine should do.
Yep.
It feels like this is what I think happened. They like picked a random set of characters to be the judges, mm-hmm. and then they needed to like make some narrative moves with Lana Milford scheming to get first place, and they couldn't have Lana Milford like reach into Pete Martell's pants in the closet or whatever. And so they had to put Dick Tremaine in there, and they had to have a character who would like roll their eyes at Lana Milford's dance, which, all right, I'm saving it for pageant talk. I'm sorry. So that's why they made the change. But I think I must have missed a line somewhere that explained that, because it seemed like a retcon.
Yeah, I think it was just to move the puzzle pieces around. To be like, okay, we need these people to be the judges. Because, like, if you put three men as the judges, then you wouldn't have Norma being able to go, like, you're all horny. What if women had brains? Like,
right. Because right.
Dick is like, oh, I think we should judge them on beauty. and poise. And it's like, what if you also, what if they were also a person, Dick? And she, he's like, oh yeah, that too, I guess. Sure.
Yeah. Whatever. I file that under talent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. There's trying to dig through stuff. There's just more Cooper Annie stuff that we, I don't like very much. He tells her he tells Diane that he loves Annie. He's talking to Diane, and then Annie knocks on the door. He interrupts it, interrupting his talk with Diane. And she's like, I need to write a speech about trees. And this scene blows. It's just really corny that he's like, I love you so much. And to hear Cooper, sweet Agent Dale Cooper, who like multiple guests have come on the show and been like, I identify with Cooper. I love him. He's my favorite. Is now like, can you play the line?
And then he's like, I want to make love to you. What? Cooper, you don't know how to do that.
You don't know where you're not allowed to do that.
Stop that.
Go. I'm going to bonk him and send him to horny jail for that one.
Yeah, you deserve to get bonked, Coop.
Does the age difference here still rub you the wrong way?
Yeah.
Oh. Startled me.
Especially when Cooper says to Diane, the reason that he likes Annie is, quote, that her responses are pure as those of a child. Mm-hmm. Excuse me, Cooper. What are you saying here, fella?
Yeah.
Like what are you valuing in Annie exactly? And then she comes to you to talk about like, hey, I want to write this speech for this thing. I get it. They're both hot for each other. They were talking about how they want to smash when they were dancing the day before, but there's like no real substantive conversation. Annie's trying to say to him, like, I have some baggage. I'm like not sure about if I'm comfortable with this. And he's like, totally, totally. Anyway, I don't want to talk about this. Let's have sex.
Yucko.
It's yucko. And it's Cooper. He handled this so much better when it was Audrey.
Mm-hmm.
And this doesn't feel functionally different in terms of the age difference, but the show is like treating it like it is when it's not. I don't know. I continue to not like it. And it continues to feel like Heather Graham's character. And I don't know if this is coming from Heather Graham, like herself not really being into it, or if the writing is just so stilted, but it really doesn't seem like Annie is like gung ho about this relationship. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Anyway.
Very disappointing. Also, like, an episode left to wrap up that stuff, but I guess it does hit a like rising action point by the end of this one.
Mm-hmm.
So the last thing that's not the pageant is just a brief scene with Nadine.
Yeah.
She's showing everybody, which is everybody being Norma, Ed, Mike, and Jacoby, a slideshow of her wrestling career. And it, just to really like put the final nail in the coffin of this plot line, Jacoby's like, yeah, you guys have to listen to her, and like we should all have open dialogue with each other. And Ed's like, we are getting, me and Norma are getting married. And then she grabs Mike's hand and goes, that's great, because Mike and I are getting married, and like crushes his hand, and he screams to cut the scene. I can't even laugh at it anymore. I'm just like bummed watching this stuff, dude. I'm so tired of Nadine. I didn't know how much there was of it.
It's taking so long. I mean, the silver lining is at the end of this episode, when all the chaos is going on, something falls on her head, and it seems like that's gonna
make her
wake up and remember who she is or something.
Finale, dude.
That's my guess.
This is gonna be the most bloated ass finale in the whole world.
Yeah, pretty good episode.
The finale is?
Yeah.
Okay, I hope so. I'm just kidding. I know it is. So let's get to the best stuff. The last like literally 15 minutes of this episode, maybe more, are the pageant, the Miss Teen Peaks pageant. There is, to my understanding, no way that this choreographed dance routine was using stunt actors. I think they trained the cast to dance. Because it's not that complicated of a dance, but it's complicated enough that I would normally say, yeah, you would use stunt actors for this. Are you joking? But there's so many shots of their faces, and it's just the actresses. Also, question, isn't Lucy pregnant? Like, very pregnant?
I don't know how far along she is at this point.
Well, she's clearly not far along enough that she can like bounce around and do a freaking full ballet. Kimmy Robertson does a ballet routine in this.
Yeah, go off, Kimmy.
Go That's off, Kimmy. Cool. Unbreakable Kimmy Robertson.
Yeah.
It was entertaining, but it just felt like padding or something. It's a lot of pageantry, literally pageantry.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Here's okay.
Pinkle?
I have a lot of things with the Miss Twin Peaks thing.
Oh, you're not going to talk about Pinkle for 15 minutes. Okay.
They made Pinkle not fun anymore, which was
now he's
a
creepy, yeah, he's a lecherous old gross man.
Yeah, which made me sad because I liked Pinkle a lot. But anyway, R.I.P. Pinkle, you're dead to me now. Rest in Pinkle. but okay, here are the things I have with the Miss Twin Peaks pageant. First of all, like I said last time, they're doing all of this like after the fact work to try to make it make sense that all of these female characters are going to be in it, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Even up to this episode, Cooper and Annie are still talking about whether Annie's going to do it.
she goes on to win.
She ends up winning. Like in this one, Audrey's being convinced of it. It's just, it's not really ever made super clear what I think. Like Donna has a clear enough reason why she's doing it, for example, because it seems like it's kind of a middle finger to her parents a little bit. But every other character who's in it, they don't really have a well-developed reason for why they're doing it that I understand from inside of them as characters. I just know the other characters who told them to do it, basically. And so what you end up with is this big narrative event that could have been a moment to explore, like, how do all of these characters feel about being at this thing that they were invested in? How do they feel about the fact that they didn't win? And you just don't get that because they didn't care. Like, Shelley has so many conversations with Bobby about whether she's going to do it or not, and you literally do not see Shelley do anything in the Miss Twin Peaks pageant.
She's in it.
She's in the background, but you don't, for a minute, you don't even see her do a single thing. And it's like, right, why did you waste all of that time talking about whether or not Shelley was going to be in it to then make it meaningless that she was there, you know? So that's really frustrating to me. I think the other thing, you know, I've criticized having this huge kind of centerpiece moment be a beauty pageant in the show where Laura Palmer's death is the inciting event, right? And everybody speaks about Laura Palmer as like, oh my God, she's so beautiful. They have her prom photo. There are so many characters who were like involved with Laura Palmer romantically or sexually or wanted to be. And a beauty pageant actually makes a lot of sense in that town where those things happen. To think that this pageant has like these deep roots in Twin Peaks that go back at least 20 years, if not more. There's a way in which that actually makes sense if you're thinking about just the sort of attitudes that had been normalized in the community up to this point and made something like what was going on with Laura Palmer something that was shuffled underneath the surface. But the problem is that this episode doesn't engage with the beauty pageant on that level. It doesn't critique it. It doesn't show it to be a part of like this problematic tapestry of a town that's fundamentally dark. It's like, hey, it's a fun show and look at all these hot ladies, you know, that's how they're presenting it to us. It's totally at face value. And it's, anyway, it sucks.
Well, I almost feel it's a little bit harsh to critique this for not tying into like what Twin Peaks was about. Because the show isn't Babylon 5. It's not a serialized show where it's all meant to connect to each other. But like, yeah, you have to reconcile in watching Twin Peaks season 2 that in the same show that is textually, fundamentally about the violence towards women and young women especially, we also end the series on a beauty pageant that is just played completely straight for so much of the season and then just plays out normally until it goes weird and doesn't even go weird for interesting reasons. Like, again, Winter Merle interrupts the Miss Twin Peaks pageant after Annie is crowned the winner. Like a freaking cartoon man. He's dressed as Margaret Lanterman, but in the wrong color outfit. Tricks Bobby, bonks him with a log, which is kind of funny. And then, like, shuts all the lights off. And we get a cool bit of directing here, right? Or, like, visuals.
With the strobing and stuff.
Yeah. There's actually a really cool strobing scene in Squid Game. Sorry to beat a dead Netflix show. But there's a really cool strobe light scene in that show that this reminded me of. But he's like slinking about, and it's pretty cool. You know, you're watching Cooper be like, oh, what do I do? And they're like, everyone get out. And him and Truman are like freaking out. And you can see Winter Merle through the, you know, through the crowd and the lights. Fairly well done here. And then they get out, Annie's gone. And they're like, well, surround him. We're going to go chase him. And that's pretty much the episode.
You don't want to talk about Lana Milford's dance and her outfit.
Oh, you mean the contortionist exotica? No. No, it's weird. This whole, like, I'm wearing a veil thing. I know the history of exotica and contortionism has its roots in a lot of different cultures, some of which are appropriative, some are not. Some are just those cultures. There's also, like, very little that's contortionist about this. She's, like, just doing a very simple dance. If I want contortionism, I want to see someone's legs bend backwards. Not that I know anything about contortionism actually as like an art form, but yeah, she just does a sexy dance that's not really that sexy, and everybody's like, blah, 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 their tongues roll out. This is right before the big win. Also, there's a great Annie speech about like protecting the environment, and it feels like Annie's the only character who actually understands what environmentalism is.
Yeah, but it also has this like Native American quotes in it that kind of has a weird appropriative vibe.
Yep, it's both, because she's on one hand saying like we owe it to people, but also like this quote comes from a Native American leader about how there are spirits in nature, and it's like you probably can't say that.
Yeah, so
I'm just glad that they didn't like pan over to Hawk and he's like, but it would be funny if it was like season one Hawk where they pan over to him and he's like eating the tiny hot just dogs chips. And he's like,
oh yeah,
your chips. He's like, huh? What? What do you guys want? But no, it's just like she ends up winning it because even though Dick Tremaine is plagued by horny disease, he still appreciates a good speech and ends up voting for her. Mm-hmm. So congrats to Annie, but you got kidnapped. And she's being taken by Winter Merle to go who knows where, probably the Black Lodge or something. I don't freaking know. I do know, but I don't know.
Yeah.
Cooper's nervous. Dwayne's pissed off that his hot girlfriend didn't win. And that's what I got. Oh, and then it ends with Andy being like, Agent Cooper, I found out what the thing is. It's not just a sign, it's a map. Cuts to credits. Yeah, right, though. They did say it's a map at the end of both two episodes in a row. That's funny. That is hilarious.
There's that scene where Lana and Dick Tremaine are in the closet together, and I just thought it was a weird, or not weird, I thought it was an interesting kind of production thing, seeing the way that that scene was edited, because every time they turn the flashlight on or off, it's like a jump cut.
Oh, yeah.
Because I'm guessing they had to actually just change the lighting setup in the room or something. And they couldn't actually like continuously shoot the scene where the flashlight turned on and off and on and off. That was just something I noticed that I thought was kind of, you know, like, oh, the way that things used to be shot, this is probably a limitation of the technology they had on hand.
Right. Pretty dope, actually. Yeah. If that's what it is.
But I got nothing else.
There's a very funny shot where I think it's Pinkles talking about like all the girls and stuff. And they just have an extra walk in front of him carrying a like lugging a deer head. That was hilarious. Just why not? This extra, I don't know what he was thinking or what they told him, but it's very funny.
It's funny.
It's so heavy deer.
Yeah.
Let's get to the finale. Yeah, we're excited to watch it.
Yeah,
we know it's got some interesting stuff. I believe. Hold on, let me confirm what I'm about to say before I say it and embarrass myself. Yeah, dude, the The finale is directed by David Lynch. We're back, baby. Mm-hmm. Twin Peaks is back. Mm-hmm. Mark Frost, Harley Payton, Robert Engels, David Lynch, uncredited writing credit. Okay, okay. Let's go, gamers. What do we got, Majon? What are we watching next time on Peaks Chat?
So next time, we are watching the final episode of season 2, episode 22, Beyond Life and Death. Agent Cooper follows
You don't have to read these.
I'm just not going to read it.
Yeah.
Just watch it.
He's gonna chase Wendell Merle. Some stuff's going to happen. I can't believe all the stuff I know about the end of Twin Peaks is in the finale. It's not even in this. I thought there's a whole plot.
There's a whole plot that I thought took up a little more time.
Seriously. Cool.
So we'll talk about that next week and sort of recap season 2 before we go into Fire Walk With Me and then ultimately into The Return.
Woohoo! Very exciting stuff.
Yeah.
Let's take it to the plug zone. Majon, can you do this one, please?
Sure. You can get in touch with the show in a couple of different ways. You can email us at chatspod@gmail.com. You can also follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/chatspod. And you can join our subreddit, reddit.com/r/chatspod, where folks are talking about old seasons of Chats. I think we're on Avatar The Last Chatsbender right now. You can also join a community of fellow listeners on our Discord, which is a benefit of being a patron at patreon.com/chatspod. Everybody $1 and up gets access to the Discord, as well as some random bonus episodes, including my solo coverage of the X-Files called The Chats Files, which recently just released a couple new episodes after a bit of a drought. Then at $3 and up, you get regular content, regular bonus episodes thrice monthly. $5 and up gets you thanked here at the end of episodes. And our $5 patrons as of right now are Kat, Marcus, Nick, and Pat of the Brothers at Infinite War, Fendon, Six, and Stefan. If you would like to support the show other ways besides money, of course, please consider sharing the show with a friend, somebody that you think would enjoy listening. And also consider rating us on places like Apple Podcasts or wherever you are catching this pod so that folks see it, see what you like about it, that kind of thing. We would really appreciate it. And then, of course, thank you as always to Camilla, who designed our logo. You can find more of Camilla's work if you search Camillustrator, and the links are also in the show notes as well. And that's the plugs. We like to talk at the very end about some little recommendations, little things for you to snack on between now and next week. We call those chatsums. Alan, what's your chatsum for this week?
Well, I was struggling to think of one just now because I'm kind of like reading the same book that I've been reading for a couple weeks now and watching some of the same shows and all that. But I actually watched a documentary for one of my business school classes this past week that I really, really enjoyed. And I would highly recommend if people somehow haven't seen it, not exactly in the usual chats framework of TV and fun media, but you should really check out the 2010 documentary Inside Job. It was directed by Charles Ferguson, and it's all about the 2008 financial crisis, primarily in the United States, but affected the rest of the world. If you have ever been curious about what was going on in 2008 and why houses suddenly were extremely expensive and why, so the economy tanked, it's a really fascinating one of those. I think in the grand scheme of documentaries, the thing I like the most about it that makes it unique is that Ferguson like is interviewing these Wall Street bankers who agreed to be in his movie. But you just get to if you've ever wanted to watch like slimy rich people lie under oath and like fall into it, it's so juicy and rewarding as somebody who has like been, you know, we've all been in some way affected by the financial crisis. Just this part's just where it's like they're trying to be like, no, you don't get to interview me anymore. And he's like, you just lied to me. Like, what can you just say words that are anything true? Answer my question. And they're like, this interview's over and that kind of stuff. And it's very satisfying and also really, really informative. So I highly recommend the 2010 documentary Inside Job. It's on YouTube. You can watch it for free on YouTube. It should be taught in schools across the world, to be honest with you. What about you, John? What's your chatsum for this week?
I have a couple chatsums. I have two YouTube channel recommendations and one video game. So the two YouTube channels are kind of media related channels, but they are different types of media. So one is video essays, historical pieces about kind of old Hollywood. The channel's called Be Kind Rewind, and it's got stuff about, you know, the Oscars and about the kind of golden era of Hollywood movies. So if you're interested in that kind of stuff, I would recommend it. There's some interesting videos on there. I learned a lot about Audrey Hepburn, for example, and the sort of erasure of like Audrey Hepburn as a person in favor of Audrey Hepburn as like an icon of nothing really. And so that video was pretty interesting. Like, I didn't know about Audrey Hepburn's personal experiences in the Holocaust, for example, and like her work with the United Nations and that kind of stuff. And then another channel that I've been enjoying, there's like a mix of like music theory, music pop culture commentary, called Song Psych. And in particular, I watched a video today that calls back to my very first or very second chatsum when I talked about how Machine Gun Kelly and Eminem were beefing.
They're beefing.
Folks remember? It turns out I watched a Song Psych video today talking about another beef that Machine Gun Kelly got himself into with the guy from Slipknot. So he's running around beefing with people. And that was a fun kind of full circle chatsum moment for me. So Song Psych and Be Kind Rewind are both pretty solid YouTube channels to add to your repertoire, I would say. And then in terms of games, today I started playing the brand new Metroid game, Metroid Dread. And I haven't developed super deep thoughts about it. I will say the gameplay itself, being Samus in this game, is really fun and fluid, and kind of prioritizes action in a way that other 2D Metroid games haven't necessarily done. I don't think it's detrimental to the Metroidvania style at all, by the way. I think it's just a sort of nice feel. There's some other stuff that they've added that is a little more obtrusive to new Metroid players. So I'm having trouble with it, having not really played a 2D Metroid game before in any substantial way. But, you know, a couple hours in, I like it so far. And I think if you like Metroid, it's a Metroid. And yeah, I'll say more about it as I have more feelings about it.
They done did a Metroid. So that was Be Kind Rewind, which I've watched before. But just so everyone knows that I've watched things. I've seen their Chloe Zhao video. The Toni Collette one is excellent. And of course, you know, I'd be standing Little Women, the movie. And the Comparing Every Version of Little Women video is really
good. Right.
Is Song Psych, can you spell that for the list, please?
Song, like psych, like psychology. S-O-N-G-P-S-Y-C-H.
Is that one word intercapitalized?
Yeah.
Perfect. Thank you. And Metroid Dread. Groombo is the name of the fictional character that I just invented. And he says all sorts of things like, thank you to Magellan for being, oh, I should really say, like, sure, being the Caroline's aorta to my Windermere or whatever. Disgusting. No, but I wouldn't say that. So instead, thank you for being the Charlie Puth to my Selena Gomez. And thank you for listening to this episode.
Nobody will get that. That was an off-pod conversation.
Fuck, I hate this. Can I have one more take, please?
Yeah.
Thank you, man. I always worry that you're going to like edit me to sound stupid, which is easy because I am.
Stop it.
Thank you to Magellan for being the Dwayne Milford to my Lana Milford. And thank you for listening to Peak Chats. Damn fine podcast.